We think women need to talk more openly about money because money really matters. It shouldn't be embarrassing or confusing. Join the conversation. We'll be discussing a whole range of topics which will help you get comfortable with your finances. Money Matters, brought to you by AJ Bell.
Hello, welcome back to the Money Matters podcast. I'm Laura Souter, and of course I'm joined by Danny Hewson. Hey, Danny.
Hi, Laura. Hi, everyone. We have made it to the start of a new financial year, and quite a few things have changed, some for the better. But I have to say that the cost of living is still stupidly high, Laura.
I know. I think I've noticed a slight, you know, reduction in some supermarket costs, I would say. We obviously also have had a national insurance cut. We've had an energy price cap cut. We also have had national living wage going up. But there's just lots of things in the mix that still make it feel like the budgets are very tight, aren't they?
Yeah, and of course, even though the energy price cap has been cut, I don't know about you, but my direct debit hasn't come down. It is still incredibly high. I'm just sort of watching every month when the bills come in, just thinking, am I enough in credit now for my direct debit to come down? Because I think when that day happens, I'll really start to feel that things are improving. But, you know, council tax has gone up, my broadband has gone up, I've got two teenage girls, as you know, they've both got mobile phones, and the cost of, you know, those have gone up as well. So yeah, expensive.
Those mobile phone, TV package, broadband, those kind of, I guess you'd lump it all in as kind of like communications or entertainment. Those bills are so high now, and that because the increases are tagged to the RPI measure of inflation, which is, this is getting into the geeky weeds of inflation, but that is always higher than the CPI measure, which is used for everything else. And then it's not just the RPI measure, it's RPI plus a bit extra. And because inflation has been so high, some of those increases are so dramatic. So I would say, you know, if you're looking at your bills and you're thinking, is there one area that I can look at? That would be my advice, is kind of look at that area, see whether you can get a new contract, switch provider, go SIM only, you know, all of those things. You can Google for lots of tips on this, but that would be an area where I think people will be very surprised when they look at their direct debit and think, oh God, that has gone up by a lot.
I like the geeky weeds. I think that that is a place that we should all inhabit for a while, sort of swim around trying to find all the deals. That would be good.
But we also had some research out that really helps to kind of bring some of the impact of these cost increases to light. And so we're going to be digging into a couple of surveys, one of them from the regulator. And that shows that millions of people are still really struggling to make ends meet and still really feeling that impact of cost of living crisis, like you said, Danny.
Yeah. And we also have, as Barbie celebrates her 65th birthday, I mean, get this, Barbie, a pensioner, we're going to be chatting to one woman who made her living for a while playing the role. No, sadly, not Margot Robbie, but Charlotte Clemmy. She was employed by Mattel to be their official Barbie here in the UK before she became a mum of three boys and decided to jump to the other side of the camera, launching her own business as a photographer. And she is brutally frank about how difficult she found getting her finances in order when she first started her self-employed journey. And I hope you've noticed, Laura, I'm wearing Barbie pink.
Very on brand. I am not. I missed that memo.
I must say that my daughters loved Barbie when they were growing up. Your little girl's probably still a bit too young to be playing with Barbies.
She is, and I think I have these mixed feelings about Barbies because they hold this place in my mind as like this very stereotypical girly toy. And so I feel like there's, even though I loved Barbie when I was younger and I loved the film recently, there's this innate thing in me of like, I don't want to be the one to buy my daughter a Barbie, even though she is doll obsessed and have every other doll under the roof. There's something, and I think it's a similar thing in my generation, of like, there's something that really plays to that kind of gender toy stereotype that I'm just, I can't quite get to, but I know as soon as she's old enough for pester power, she will be pestering me for that Barbie.
Well, my kids had Barbies with dogs, so it was, you know, dog walker Barbie, it was teacher Barbie, you know, it's all about the different kind of roles that she plays, which is something that they absolutely love. So it is very much now, the dolls aren't just about pretty pink frocks, although they did have a lot of frocks and shoes and, you know, that kind of stuff, but it's also about girl power.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what I've got to get on the same page as, and I've got to do a bit more research, I think, probably.
We did end up with a lot of Barbie heads though, which was quite strange. They do that manage to lose their heads, which is quite grim. Yes.
But also one thing people will probably find is that Barbies are very expensive. Like all children's toys, I am discovering, if you don't get them secondhand and from the charity shop, they are pricey.
Yes, they are.
Like we mentioned at the top of the show, something that people are still really conscious about. And so the cost of living crisis might not be making the same kind of headlines that it was, and it might feel like we're kind of on the tail end of it. But actually, we've had a new report out from the regulator, the Financial Conduct Authority, which showed that more than 7 million households are still struggling to pay their bills. So this is research from January this year, so very current, and asking people how they're feeling about the cost of living crisis and the financial impact that it's still having on them. And what it found is that there's 7.4 million people are still either struggling to pay bills or to meet their credit payments, so for credit cards, loans or mortgages. Now, it's a significant improvement. So this is down from almost 11 million in January last year. So a big improvement. However, we've still got about 1.5 million people more that are struggling to pay these bills than were pre-cost of living crisis, so way back in 2020. We've got more than 5 million people who say that they've fallen behind or missed a payment. That's in the past 6 months, and that's down on a year earlier. So I think what we're seeing overall is an improving picture, but still, as we can see here through these numbers, millions of people still struggling to pay bills or missing payments. And there's a few stats that I thought might resonate with people. So just over 10% of people said they have no disposable income each month. Nearly a quarter of people have used savings or investments just to cover their daily costs. And just under half of people, 44%, said they've either stopped saving or investing, or they've reduced the amount that they're putting away each month. And so I think some of those stats people will be listening to and saying, yes, that is me. I am feeling that too.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone will be surprised that the survey sort of was drilling into where people were most impacted. And it said that people on low incomes, single parents, those unemployed were the ones most likely to be impacted in this way, to still be struggling with the cost of living. And something which was really interesting, but actually isn't surprising when you think about it, is that renters, people renting property rather than owning property, tend to be more at risk of still really struggling. Now, it found that around 2/3 of renters had said that their rents had gone up in the previous 12 months, and a half said they weren't coping with that increase. And when you look into the numbers of those that had fallen behind on bills, it was 26% of renters said that versus 11% of other people. So I think you can really see the impact of those interest rates, the fact that we are seeing an awful lot of landlords sort of getting out of renting houses to people, and the fact that there just isn't the supply. And, you know, that is having a massive impact on people's lives.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that really came out in the research that we've talked about a bit before, and I think has been a real theme going through the cost of living crisis, is this real kind of divided nation, this real split in terms of people who are really feeling the brunt of rising prices and those who are actually doing okay. And I'm sure we've got some from each group among our listeners. But, you know, on the one hand, there's these huge portions of the population that have kind of blitzed through their savings, any savings that they made during lockdown. And they're now living month to month with no cushion to fall back on and no disposable income. But on the flip side of it, what these figures show is actually there's a very healthy number of people, proportion of the population that have got money to spare each month. They've either got money to save or to invest or to spend on luxuries. If we think about some of those figures that I talked about earlier, so we've got almost a quarter of people who have used savings or investments to cover their day-to-day costs, and then 44% of people who've stopped saving or investing or reduced those amounts. But what that means is actually we've got half of people who haven't stopped saving and investing, and actually maybe have even increased the amount that they are saving and investing. So I think what we've got is this real divide. If your wages have been able to keep up with the cost of living crisis or even perhaps exceed it, if you were fairly comfortably off before, if you're not in one of those groups, Danny, like you identified, that, you know, are struggling financially, if you're not renting, if you own your own home and you don't have a mortgage on it and therefore you're not really exposed to interest rate rises, a lot of those households are doing okay. And that is a broad brush statement. Lots of them won't be. So if you're shouting at your at me right now saying that is not the case, we know that there's lots of individual circumstances, but it really does show that there's lots of people that still can put money away, still can save, and there's lots of people that are struggling.
I do remember post-pandemic, we were looking at the GDP figures sort of bouncing back, and a lot of organisations were saying, look, what we can expect in terms of a recovery is going to be a K-shaped recovery, not a W or a V, a double-dip recession or whatever you like.
But what's K-shaped recovery?
So what you would see is effectively half the population recovering very quickly and the other half going down, continuing to go down and really struggling until the economy changes, until their fortunes start to change. And, you know, even before the cost of living crisis, that was certainly something that was on the table. Something that really caught my attention was KPMG put out a consumer pulse survey a couple of days ago. And it had the usual stuff. So 52% had said that they cut back on non-essential spend, and, you know, that the biggest cutback had been eating out and on clothing and takeaways and that kind of thing. No surprises. But what did surprise me, and what really seems to suggest that people's ideas about budgeting and about making sure that they protect themselves from any other potential impacts, any other, you know, recessions or whatever, is that even when prices start to come down, very few people said that they would immediately start to spend more on non-essential stuff. So 44% actually said that if prices start to come down, then they'll look to increase their savings cushion in order to try and give themselves some kind of protection. And just exactly what we were just talking about some people being more affected than others, 11% were saying that they would, 20% said that they would actually then be able to spend more on essential stuff, and only 11% said that they would spend more on non-essential. So I found it really interesting that I think people have now started thinking differently about money. They understand the importance of building themselves some kind of a cushion when they can, and that it is okay to say, no, I'm not going to spend on, you know, the latest shirt or going out for dinner or a takeaway. I am going to put that money aside because I need to have it to protect me from future blows. But yeah, fascinating.
That is so interesting. And I think you wonder then whether this will be a kind of cause a bit of a generational shift in how we spend money. If you think back, this is maybe a slightly strange analogy, but when I used to bake with my gran, she was in the wartime era, and if I overused a bit of butter, she would go crazy at me because she was from that rationing era where butter was this real luxury and you had to really make it stretch. And this was way after the war, when she was in her 80s. And so there are these kind of defining moments. Now, I'm not saying the cost of living crisis is on an equal par with the war, but I'm just saying that maybe there has been this shift in attitudes. There's been this ability to talk about money more and to say, I can't afford that, or to really cut back and realize, oh, those things that I was spending money on maybe I don't need, and you wonder whether that will persist, but also crucially how long it will persist for, because we know that people often do have short memories, and as soon as you get back into spending that little bit more, that lifestyle creeping up, then it becomes a thing of the past, doesn't it?
Well, some figures that I know will absolutely chime with you, holiday lover, is that of the big ticket items that people have spent money on in the last couple of months, holidays, that is the big thing that people are still budgeting for, putting money aside for, perhaps thinking that actually it's a necessity. It's not a discretionary spend. Having those moments with family and friends, that minute in the sun, considering what the weather has been like, is actually really important.
Yeah, and that's got to be a kind of, still got to be a post-pandemic, post-lockdown kind of fallout thing, hasn't it? Of like valuing those experiences, valuing being able to travel and spending time with your loved ones. But I think all of this kind of, you know, the cost of living crisis is to a certain amount dictated or demonstrated by inflation. And we've got another reading of inflation coming out. We're expecting a drop. We're expecting energy prices to kind of filter through into that. But there have been some concerns raised about so-called sticky inflation, which, Danny, I know you've been talking about a lot. But effectively, this means inflation that doesn't quite drop to the levels that the government and policymakers want it to, and kind of drifts on rather than doing this straight down drop that lots of people are expecting. And we know that that has a knock-on effect on interest rate cuts. So if inflation does prove sticky and stays higher than was predicted, then we're going to see a delay in when we see interest rate cuts. And we always talk about what the market's expecting, and this does change, and it's certainly not set in stone, but that has changed dramatically. So from January this year, markets were expecting up to 6 interest rate cuts this year. Now markets are pricing in just 2, with the first of those being, you know, August, September time potentially. But I think that just really highlights, that's in the space of a few months, how expectations have changed. And as we get more data, things happen globally. It's not just what happens in the UK. That all filters through into the impact of on interest rates. And so that's kind of an updated expectation, but with the huge caveat that nothing is set in stone, and we clearly don't know exactly what policymakers are going to do.
I do wish that we had some kind of crystal ball. I think that would come in very handy a lot of time when we're asked questions about this kind of stuff.
We'd also be so much richer, Danny. Let's not just think about the questions. We'd be very wealthy if we knew exactly what was going to happen in markets.
Look, it is time now to hear from this episode's special guest. Charlotte Clemmy first made her mark when she won the coveted job of being Mattel's official Barbie here in the UK.
And she went on to become Ms. GB. She's mum of 3 boys, and she now makes her living on the other side of the camera as a photographer who works primarily with women. She spoke to Danny about stepping out of Barbie's shadow and also the tough lessons she had to learn when she started her own business.
Okay, I suppose the first question has to be, how did you become Barbie?
Well, it is one of those fun topics. I think when I tell people, they're like, what? That couldn't have actually been your real job. And I think at the beginning, people think that maybe I just stuck on a pink dress and turned up at kids' birthday parties or something like that. But no, it was official Barbie for Mattel. And I got it through an audition. So at the time I was with a model agency in Manchester, and the job came up and I got put forward, and I was thinking, this is literally like my dream job. I would love this. So of course you had to go for your interview, which was at the head office, which was down south. So I went down for the interview and then got called for a second interview and then got the job, and that was it. And it was literally the best 5 years.
So what did you do as Barbie?
Literally all types of jobs. It was such an amazing experience. They, at the time, because this was going back about 10 years ago, even longer actually, they used to have loads of Barbie movies that were released at the time. So I would go to all the movie premieres where they would invite celebrities and their kids to come and watch the Barbie movie. So I got to meet the Spice Girls and all sorts doing that. They would meet Barbie, they'd come on the pink carpet and watch the film, and I would introduce the film. So I would introduce it with like people like Kate Garraway off the TV and different famous celebrities. So it was really glamorous. And they ran a lot of competitions. So the competitions that you see in the back of a Barbie box that you kind of think, is that even real? Well, they were definitely real. So you could win your bedroom designed by Barbie. So you could enter the competition, and they came to Barbie's head office, and I was there dressed as Barbie. And then together we sat with the designer and designed their bedrooms. And then a really special job was actually going every year to the Great Ormond Street Christmas party. So at that, they had tons of celebrities there, the children from Great Ormond Street, and I did an appearance as well. And it was just a big Christmas party. So it really varied, so many different types of appearances.
Now, since the Barbie movie, I think there's been a real sea change in the way people talk about Barbie. I mean, people have embraced pink. I'm in pink right now. But not everybody had the same soft spot for Barbie for a while. Did you ever get any backlash?
It was quite rare. There was a couple of times. I remember I was at Smith's toy store. If they launched like a new doll, that would be another job that I would go down to the toy store, and you could get a picture and things with Barbie. But there was only a couple of times that somebody had said that they kind of didn't agree with what I was representing, and they didn't want their children to have anything to do with it. And I could see where people were coming from, but I think what they didn't understand was that there was a big shift being made, and Mattel really were trying to make that shift, that, you know, that Be Anything campaign. And that was kind of what I had to push a lot of the times when I was on the appearance, that, you know, it was Barbie celebrates everybody, you can be anything. And that was like the big push. And I noticed that they talked about that a lot in the movie as well. So, you know, that was the big tagline behind my role.
And Barbie did give you the opportunity as well to be anything. And I want to talk a bit more about what you're doing now. But you had a really strong work ethic anyway.
Yeah, I've always worked since the age of 14. I've come from a really sort of humble beginnings. So for me, I mean, I'm a daughter of two mums myself. My mum was a single parent, and then she met her partner Mary when I was about 10. So I've grown up from very sort of humble background. So for me to kind of get the latest jeans or anything, the latest CD, it was down to me to get it. So at the age of 14, I went out and got my first job as a waitress. I think I lied and said I was 16. So that I could work and serve alcohol in the restaurants. But I absolutely loved it because I had my own cash. I was able to go and, you know, like I say, buy whatever I wanted. I've always loved having that financial independence, even from that young age.
And I'm guessing then that you also, from a very young age, started thinking about maintaining that financial independence, so making sure that you had savings set aside, you were thinking about the future.
Yeah, I've always been really careful with money, and, you know, I've never kind of been the type that would just kind of go out on like a wild shopping spree. That's not me at all. I've kind of always been really careful, and I only really buy things that I've needed, or that, you know, I've never been like a designer person that would rush out and buy a handbag. For me, that just, it wouldn't excite me at all unless I had the funds for it. So I have always been really cautious about it. But with the Barbie job, you know, it was such an amazing opportunity because it was paid really well. You know, it really did give me that financial freedom as well, like throughout my 20s.
And you used that money then because you didn't stay Barbie forever. You've got three boys, and, you know, obviously becoming a mum of three boys, I guess that sort of kind of put a full stop on things for a while, but you had that cushion then to take that and start your own business.
Yeah, well, even alongside working as Barbie, I was always doing other bits and bobs in between, other modelling jobs. But like I say, I've always loved working. I've always loved throwing myself into new experiences. But then whenever I decided to start a family, the Barbie career did have to come to an end. Because if you have seen the movie, there is a funny part where they say, oh, there's pregnant Barbie, but she was discontinued. And that did make me laugh when I watched the film, because I was like, that was me. to be fair, I think I worked up until I was 15 weeks pregnant. And then, yeah, then I had to stop. And they did offer me the job back once I'd had my first boy. But there was a lot of traveling, and it just was never going to work. Breastfeeding with a baby, being Barbie, it just wasn't for me anyway. And that's when I kind of thought, what can I do now that still makes, you know, a job that I work with people? I love working with people. I've never worked in an office. I don't think I would be suitable at all. I've always enjoyed being self-employed as well, and being my own boss in that sense. So I kind of thought, what could I do? And that's when I thought, do you know what? Photography, on the other side of the camera. And then I started my photography business.
And you're now juggling that as mum of three boys. How do you do that juggle?
They're all now at a really good age. They're 8, 7, and 4. So the last, I'd say, 18 months have been a lot easier because they're all in school. So that has been a huge help. I've always used childcare as well. You know, from, I think, 5 months, they've all gone into childcare, because I do enjoy working. I know some women really enjoy that time at home and they kind of maybe take a few years off. That was never going to excite me at all. I really love going out to work. I love doing something that's about me and not just always about being a mum. So that is something that's important to me. So the juggle is definitely hard, but there's a lot of support with childcare. My husband was in the police. He left the police because shift work was a bit of a nightmare, and he's now in a 9-to-5. So between the two of us, it all kind of works. Don't get me wrong, our house is very chaotic. And I do a lot of late night editing, but it works.
And you were doing this juggle and getting the business properly off the ground. How did you go about getting funding, making sure that you understood the finances? I mean, you've always been self-employed, but did you get help with that?
Well, it's an interesting one, that, really, because I've got dyslexia and I've got a very creative brain, and I'm really good at coming up with ideas. I've loved the marketing side of my business. I really enjoy using social media. My sort of main part of my business is photographing pageant girls and models, and I'm very much involved in that industry anyway. So a lot of word of mouth and a lot of connections that I've got within that industry really helped build my business. However, the books side of things was something that I was definitely not a strength of mine at all. And that's been a huge learning, I think, over the last sort of 3-4 years post-COVID, when the business really did start to generate a lot of money. My books weren't up to scratch at all, and I had 2 years of hard lessons and huge tax bills while I was sorting out all my accounts. So it's one of those funny things, because you can be a great photographer, and but if you don't know the number side of things, you can't run a business. And that was the side that was bringing me down, that now, only the last tax year, I've now got myself right and I know what I'm doing money wise.
Because it's hard and it's complicated. And, you know, if you're juggling life as a mum of three boys, plus launching a business which becomes very successful, that's a lot of balls to keep juggling.
Yeah, and for me as well, I was terrible at keeping receipts. I was paying for things in cash, so I didn't even have any proof of what I paid for the business. If I bought a new camera, sometimes I would pay it in cash. It was a mess. My accountant was basically saying, your accounts are a mess. This was why I had such a huge tax bill. And I think I spent about a week crying, thinking, what is the point? I may as well get a job, you know, in a local shop and have none of this stress and go home every night and be able to watch TV without stressing about different things. So, it's been a huge learning curve for me. My father-in-law is a really good businessman as well, and he was able to give me some great advice. So I was really lucky there. But I think I was a bit naive when it came to the numbers side of running a business.
Now, you mentioned that you do a lot of work with pageant girls. You're still involved in that now. So I know that there is still a stigma attached, but actually that is now all about supporting and lifting up women.
Yeah, and I think a great example would be the Barbie movie, because I think 99% of the people I've spoken to absolutely loved that movie. And the whole time I was watching it, I was thinking, this is just like a pageant. This is just like a pageant. It's such a fun, welcoming community of women. And thank God, gone are the days of you have to be white, size 8. That's not how it is at all now. They embrace every different body shape, ethnicity, background. And back in the day, you couldn't be married, you couldn't have children. When you look back now, it's just absolutely horrendous. No wonder it still has that stigma, but it's now all organized by women. All the directors are female, the judging panels are female, and it's a lot more about the person, what they want to do with their title, what their platform is. So for me personally, I entered Miss Great Britain, which is the oldest pageant in the UK, and now they've got a category for over 30. So I entered that 2 years ago and won that. And my platform was all about trying to really encourage parents to bring up their sons as feminists. So it gave me that amazing platform to speak about that important topic.
What is it about the opportunity to talk, to spread your message, that really chimes with you? And is there ever any time when you feel nervous about getting out there? Because I know public speaking is something that a lot of women struggle with.
Yeah, and I think that's what pageants are really good for. I think especially with younger women, it really pushes them out of their comfort zone. You have an interview, you have to do an onstage question, you don't know what these questions are going to be. And I think pageants, have a lot to be said for in terms of really helping women gain confidence, and especially with public speaking. So for me, where we met at the SmartWorks events, for me, speaking in front of people just is second nature, because I have been involved with the pageant industry since I was 17. So that's 20 years. I'm really used to speaking in front of people. It doesn't scare me at all. And I do think a lot of that is down to pageants.
So you also, as part of the photography business that you run, don't just work with women in pageants, but you also help businesswomen and women in general feel comfortable in front of the camera, feel comfortable with their own bodies, because sometimes having your photograph taken is absolutely terrifying as well. How did you start thinking about that, and why?
I mean, everybody who comes through my studio doors is female, and I'm all about the female energy. And I know how scary it is having your photo taken. Even when I used to model, every single time I went to a photo shoot, I was nervous. What if I did something wrong? What if I did something that looked really stupid? So as soon as the woman comes into the studio, it's our job, me and the hair and makeup team, to make sure that they feel immediately relaxed and it's a fun experience. And I always just say to people when they're at the booking stage, look, this is meant to be a fun experience. You're going to leave feeling really empowered and confident, and hopefully you'll get some photos. That's the bonus. So it's the whole experience that I want them to have. It's not just a quick come in for a quick few headshots and leave. It really is that lovely experience that they talk about after. But I think I am good at putting people at ease. I'm just chatting to them like I'm chatting to you now. It's very informal. It's very relaxed. If they've got their hair and makeup done, they already feel a bit more confident than they did when they arrived. And it's the magic of all that coming together that I think creates these amazing images that, 99%, nearly 100%, I think people are happy with their photos.
So that's where you are at the moment. That's Barbie's chapter right now. What's next? What would you like to do in the next 10, 20 years? Because you've accomplished a lot already.
Oh, thank you. No, there's still so much more that I want to do. For me, I'm always about self-development. I'm always listening to podcasts. That's why I'm so happy that I found your one as well. And I'm always striving to do more and to better myself. For me, in terms of my business side of things, I really want to start working with more brands. So 2 years ago, I started my destination shoots, which were, again, for women to experience a destination shoot and have that sort of supermodel moment. Of course, we see all these models who get jetted off here, there and everywhere in these amazing shoots. And your everyday woman, say, won't get that experience. And most of my clients have normal jobs. You know, they're doctors, they're nurses, they're cleaners, they work in an office. So I created these shoot experiences for them to come, get glammed, be on the beach, get these amazing photos. Especially when we were in Venice, we had, you know, passers-by taking photos on the phone because they're thinking, who is this? Is this a celebrity? So it's really nice for the women and the girls to experience that. And I really want to take them to the next level and get more brands involved and work with bigger brands on bigger scale shoots with art directors. So there's so much more growth that I need to do. But yeah, it's just taking those little steps while trying to manage the family life as well.
And you love the film?
Oh my gosh, I love the film. I went 3 times. Like I said, there are so many moments that I was like, oh yeah, that's like me. Oh, that's true. Oh, that's really funny. Oh, I've been to Mattel's head office. There were so many bits in it that I could connect with that I just loved it. And I cried loads. I'm a sucker for crying, but there were so many emotional moments. And like I say, my mom is like the biggest feminist going. She came with me and she just loved it and was in tears. And we just had such a good time.
Well, Clemmie, look, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlotte Clemmie there. Now, Charlotte was incredibly honest about the struggles that she faced when she first started her photography business, Charlotte Clemmie Photography, and that difficulty with keeping on top of her finances was at the heart of her confession. And before we switch off, just going to get you to do your financial confession.
Well, I kind of touched on it slightly before, and I think it was that despite being, you know, on social media looking like I was a very successful photographer, the back end of things, the business was a mess in terms of my books, and I was hit hard and a huge lesson with a tax bill that really nearly shut everything down because I hadn't been doing my books right at all. And that was kind of, that's my confession. It was, you know, to actually take the business side of things seriously and the number side of things, because if I'm not doing that right, it doesn't matter how good the photo is, I'm not going to have a business. So getting set up with Sage and doing my accounts weekly, doing my mileage, keeping all of my receipts, and just being a lot more savvy on the number side of it, and realizing if I don't do that, I can't take a photo. So that's my confession, to really try and have learned that balance of, yes, great photos, but you've got to have your books done.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Danny.
I think this is a common one for anyone who goes self-employed or starts their own business. I remember the Scummy Mummies, when we had them on the podcast, they talked about a similar thing. And it's that thing of being really good at what you do, at the business of what you do, but just not being so genned up and clued up on the business side of things, particularly if you don't have friends or family around you that have also been self-employed. I think surrounding yourself with a good accountant is always a good tip, isn't it? Even if it does cost money.
It is a good tip. And I take my hat off to anyone that starts their own business, because it takes a great deal of faith and discipline and, of course, you know, good old fashioned graft. So thank you so much to Charlotte for talking to us about her life. And thanks to our charity partner Smartworks for introducing her to us.
And do get in touch if you've got a story to share or a topic that we think should be covering or a guest that you really want us to get on. You can email us at hello@ajbellmoneymatters.co.uk.
And of course, you can always message us on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram and X at AJ Bell Money Matters. And we hope that we will see some of you at Anything Is Possible Live in Manchester in a couple of weeks' time. You'll find us on the finance stage.
And we've got some fantastic guests coming up on the podcast over the next few weeks. So make sure that you sign up to our newsletter, which you can access on our website, AJ Bell Money Matters. .co.uk, and that will mean that you don't miss anything. Until next time, thanks a lot for listening.
Before you go, please remember this podcast is for educational purposes, and the views expressed don't necessarily reflect those of AJ Bell. The podcast isn't telling you if a certain investment is suitable or not. Don't forget that the value of investments can change, and you can lose money as well as make it. It's also important to remember that how you're taxed will depend on your individual circumstances, and rules can change. The way an investment performed in the past may not be the same as how it behaves in the future. If you want help, go see a qualified financial advisor.